Hello and welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio. And this week it's Alan Phillips on the air with us, WA0YAS. He is from near Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And not only is he a radio amateur, but he's also the head of Ghost Hunters Incorporated. And they use all kinds of electronic gadgets in what they do. We'll be talking about that right now on QSO. With us is Alan Phillips, WA0YAS, amateur radio operator. And what's your QTH there, Alan?
Okay, we're in Sinking Spring, and that's roughly about 50 miles northwest of Philadelphia, so in Minberks County.
So you're a Pennsylvania fella.
A Pennsylvania boy, yep.
Very good. Well, tell me a little bit about your ham radio interests. What all are you involved in, and you know how did you get in the middle of amateur radio to start with?
Okay, well that's basically simple. Back in the 70s, like most ham operators and amateur radio operators, I started out with that thing known as the 11 meter band. And, of course, on the 11 meters, they had the sideband, and that's basically where I hung out. And I thought, well, gee, this is so cool this way and everything. And, of course, back in the 70s, might get my age away a little bit, but I was doing all this stuff. It's like, well, there's got to be more. Well, I ran across some friends of mine who said, hey, you know, there is more. There's you can talk all over the world. I said, oh, yeah? I can talk over the world, and I can do it legally. So they said, oh, yeah. So that's basically how I first got into it. Of course, at that time, I had other things I was doing, being young and in my late teens, early 20s, and I never followed through with it like I wanted to. But it was about, I guess, about 2003 when I actually settled down.
Now, tell me, what was your first Citizens band rig?
My first Citizens band rig for bass unit was a Midland 23 channel. With the old D-104 Silver Eagle mic.
Well, yeah, it's interesting because, see, when I started in ham radio, that was preceded in my years by Citizens Band. And, of course, I was in the Detroit, Michigan area, actually Dearborn Heights. And there was a whole group of people that operated Citizens Band, and they were very friendly folks. It was a community. But I was going to say the radios that I remember probably predate your radios because I was into the Citiphone SS and the Comstat 25 Lafayette and the Olson Sidebander. And you probably never heard of those radios.
I've heard of some of them, but yeah, they're going way back there, I guess. Well, the first one I ever really heard of that was interesting was when they started going from the, I guess you could say, the transistor and tube hybrids, like the Yaesu ST-101 double echo, which I have. I have the old SBE-36, which was the 300-watt version and the American-made version of the Yaesu. So,
well, you know,
collection.
The Yaesu EE was a very popular Citizens Band radio. I mean, a lot of guys had those that were operating, and they would operate, I don't know, they'd get outside of the Citizens Band, they'd go in between, I don't know if it was 10. I never was involved in that because I was into ham radio by the time all I started up, but... back when I was in it, of course, the big gun was out there in, what was it, Scotts Bluff, Nebraska, and there was a company called DNA, and they made these linear amplifiers out of sweep tubes, and I remember they had a Maverick 250, they had a Phantom 500, I think they had a Raider. Raider was like 100 watts, the Maverick was 250, and the Phantom was 500. Because I had a lot of fellows bring me those things to service. I was, you know, young, and they, can you fix this, you know? Yeah, working on those things. Back then, I don't know. I mean, it was like that was a pre-ham radio thing. Now, of course, hams at that time just shuddered at anyone operating on Citizens Band. But then, you know, it was, I guess I want to say, it was a quick start back then. It was a way to get on the air and talk. And of course, the ones that were going to become hams were going to become hams one way or the other. I mean, they were just going to move in that direction. Didn't matter. Because their interest is so intense. I mean, they want to know more about it. And they would just eventually wind up in ham radio. But Citizens Band was a way. I remember some of the antennas. Now, I don't know if you remember any of these, but the, the base antennas was, let me see here, CLR2 was made by High Gain. And another one was called a Super Magnum or a Super Mag antenna, which was red, made by antenna specialists. I don't know if you... Oh,
yeah,
man,
yeah,
you don't
remember the antenna specialists, yeah.
I'm going back beyond you, boy. I'm you know, okay, so you said, well, I'm showing my age. I guess I should just shut up while I'm ahead here. But anyways, there's a lot of folks got into it. Now, of course, now with the licensing set up the way it is and the code no longer a requirement and all that, and the technician license as easy as it is to get, it's really opened the door wide, you know, to the hobby from folks that, and of course, the code, it really was not the obstacle that a lot of people thought it was. It was just it was one of those things you perceived as being impossible or difficult, and that held a lot of people back. A lot of people got hamstrung over the code. Their fear of it was really the worst thing. It wasn't the actual code itself. Is they were just afraid of the, you know, I can't memorize all that. I can't do all that. All those dots and dashes, and you know. But actually, really, once someone started getting trained in CW, learning it by sound, letter sound, rather than by dots and dashes, they breeze right through it. You know, you could teach somebody the code in a matter of 3 days, you know, and they'd be up to five words a minute by the end of the week, you know. So it wasn't much of a, okay, you had a Citizens Band radio, 23 channel, and how did you go from Citizens Band into ham? How did that transition take place?
Well, actually, that's interesting as well, because I had a friend of mine who was also a ham as well as a Citizens Band operator, and he invited me over to his house one day, and he said, we have this thing as a ham operator. He says, we have this thing we do every year called Field Day. And he says, you know, if you want, you can come over to my house. You can operate since, you know, that's how he said, you can see what it's about. So it's like, hey, what the heck, you know, why not? So I spent the good part of the day over at his house, and that's all I did was I operated his rig. What was it? N3A something F, if I'm not mistaken. But I got to tell you, I thought, hey, this is cool. I'm talking to all these different places, all these different states, and it's like, wow, you know, it's the greatest. Like, I'm doing this legally. So, and he had an old, I guess it's an old Tentec. I forget what model number, but it was like, this is great. This is fantastic. And that, from that day on, I knew, okay, this, I got to do this. I got to get ham license. I got to get out there. I got to talk to these people. I got to become part of, back then, what they considered the elite in the radio operating. You know what I mean? It's like, this is me. This is what I want. So, like I said, I kind of put it on the side burner for a little bit. And I guess about 2003, well, it was 2003, that the better half and I moved out to Missouri. And on the way out there, of course, we had a big old 35-foot U-Haul, you know, all our stuff in there, pulling my Jeep out there and everything. And she got interested on the CB, heard some of the stuff, the way the truckers would talk on the CB, you know, with, you know, about their mileage markers and all this. And she'd sit there and ask people, what were they saying? So I'd tell her. And she thought, oh, this is cool. I said, well, you know what? You think that's cool? I said, there's something even more cool than CB radio. This is Man's Radio. She goes, oh, yeah? I said, yeah, talking around the world and using anywhere up to 1,500 watts is the ultimate. She goes, oh, yeah, and what's that? I said, well, some people know it as ham radio. I said, a lot of people, though, will tell you amateur radio. She says, oh, yeah, well, what do you got to do? So I explained the whole nine yards, and her and I sort of made like a little competition out of it to see who would, you know, get what first. And it started out, like I said, we got our technician, which that's Y0. We were out in Missouri at the time, and we made a competition. So it's like, all right, well, I'm going to do better on my technician than you are, and vice versa, which I did better on my technician than her. But when it comes to our general and extra class, I'm shameless to say that she got me first. But it's been a blast, and I'll tell you what, I've got to talk European Russia. I've talked into Nigeria, down in Africa. I've talked the UK, you know, Spain, some of the smaller countries, Estonia, Georgia. So it's a blast. Plus, you know, I got to say, Ted, I've met a heck of a lot of nice people. And a lot of my friends on the local repeaters here, 2 meters and 70 centimeters, they all know me as Hawk. So it's a great bunch of guys, and I've gotten involved with so many other community services, Skywarn, Aries Racies, all kinds of stuff. As a matter of fact, come up the first, second, and third of June, we have the World War II air shows out here every year, which one of the local clubs here that I'm associated with has been asked to do communications for the event. So I'll probably be out there doing the same thing and put my time in and having a blast like I always do. I mean, great bunch of guys, and I love it. And I wouldn't have it any other way. And you know what? I'm glad I got my ham license now because it's the greatest hobby there is, in my opinion.
Well, let me ask you this question. What bands do you the most currently?
Currently, I'd probably say 40 meters, and at this point, 60 meters. And, of course, when it's open, good old 10 meters, but mostly 60 and 40 meters at this point.
What do you like specifically, let's say, about the 40-meter band?
I like it because depending on the time of day, you know, you have better connections when there's DX, and plus, like, for stateside talking, it's a whole lot more fun. Like, I just about every day, 7218, I talk to a friend of mine out in Missouri, which his name's Lee Ray, AB0PD is his call, and it's like, you know, this way I can keep in touch with them. Or like, if I want to get a message out to my brother, for example, I can just say, "Hey, Lee Ray, here's my brother's number. You know, give him a call, let him know this or whatever." So, it's the fact, you know, the camaraderie, and you know, it's just everything in general. I mean, it's fantastic. And like with 60 meters, for example, I guess everybody knows that the Canadians have just started an experimental thing with 60 meters. And I was lucky enough to talk to the very first Canadian to get that, I guess they call it the experimental license, the VX license, which that was VX9, what was it? Yeah, VX9 Golf Hotel Delta. So his name was Russ, so that was kind of neat, which I now have a Canadian QSL card. He's up in Ontario, and I sent him mine a couple of days ago, so hopefully he's got mine as well by now. So it's fun. It's a great hobby. I love it.
Do you work any CW at all?
I haven't got to work like I like to because at this point I'm still not as good as I want to be, but I've tried it, and I'm practicing locally with some friends of mine and stuff, so eventually I'll get there to where I can really get out there and get it and do the CW. And I also want to do some of the other stuff like PSK 31 and some of that other good digital modes as well.
You know, I guess I want to say one of the things I think a lot of times people hesitate to get on CW because they think, well, I just can't go fast enough, you know, and I'm just going to get left in the dirt, you know. But you know what? There's somebody else out there that's thinking the same thing. So I wouldn't be afraid to get on and call a nice, slow CQ in CW, you know. And
I agree.
You know, and communicate with someone because there's always somebody out there thinking the same exact thing that you're thinking, and that is, I don't want to get on there and go that slow, you know.
That's true.
You know, that's go ahead.
I was just going to say, well, you know, for me, that is what ham radio is all about, an amateur radio, because even though they don't have the requirement now, there's still, I guess, what I want to say, I guess like maybe the glamour behind the actual amateur radio operating, you know, that was like the very first thing that was there. I guess technically you could say that was the first digital mode, actually. So even though, in my opinion, even though you don't have to pass any five words or whatever anymore, it's still, I do it, and I want to do it and learn it and be more proficient at it just for the fact it's like the nostalgic thing. It's just ham radio is the only way I can say it. You know, that was there before they had phone and everything, that all these other digital modes and everything. So it's the nostalgic that I like about it.
Well, you know, I guess when we were at the Huntsville Hamfest back, I don't know, years ago, we were right next door to the Vibroplex people. And I talked to them, and the guy said, well, since they lifted the code requirement, we're selling more bugs than ever. You know, more keys, more bugs, you know. And basically, Martin Jewis said the same thing. He sells a lot more CW stuff now than he did back during when it was a requirement, which is kind of crazy. But I think that's what it is. It's the requirement's been lifted. People feel a lot more easy about it. You know, there's more there to get excited about because they can learn it at their own pace. There's no pressure, and it's become a nostalgic thing. You know, as before it was a requirement. So I think that made made a huge difference. Well, tell me a little bit about your. Are you a member of a local club there?
Yeah, it's the Berks Amateur Radio Club. And then, of course, we have, like I said earlier, I'm also a member of our local Berks County Area Tracy's team. So we get to, I think that's not only the part about ham radio, that being able to sit there and rag to with your friends and stuff. But I think the community part is one of the more important reasons why I got into it. And so pretty much both aspects are pretty neat. And I have fun every 2 years. We have we're next to a power plant, atomic power plant. And every 2 years we have a drill for that in case something goes wrong. And hopefully it never will, if God's willing, you know. So, but it's fun. And we've had mock drills around here locally that we practice with our local Aries Racing unit. Like, we've had several incidences where we'd have mock floods and stuff from, you know, weather-related incidents like hurricanes and stuff. And so I get to do that stuff whenever I can, and it's fun. And, you know, you're having fun while you're doing it. And not only are you having the fun, but whether some people realize or not, they participate in stuff like this. They're actually learning. They're learning how to pass messages in an emergency. And, you know, they're having fun, but they don't realize all this. But when the time comes to actually be deployed in an emergency situation, they're going to think twice. You know, they're not even going to think twice. They're just going to blur right out there and pass the messages word for word, and it's going to be like a second nature to them. And this is another thing about why I would sit there and recommend anybody to, you know, from technician on up, if they're not involved in something like that, to get involved in their local Aries Races or Skywarn or anything like that, and become more community oriented. And you'll find there's a lot more gratification as you go on and do this stuff.
Now, do you participate in your local Skywarn team?
Oh, absolutely. Every time there's an incident that we come up and I hear our Skywarn activation, oh yeah, I have a little dual bander, that HT of 440 and 2 meter that I take. So I even take it to work with me. So I'm always sitting there. And every Thursday night we have a Skywarn net, which covers three states. Yeah, no, four states actually: Pennsylvania, Delaware, New Jersey, and Maryland. So, and it's on a 440 repeater. Of course, we're all linked together. But yeah, every weekend or every Thursday night, yeah, I'm there checking in for nothing else. Just say, hey, I'm here, guys.
Well, how do they work it? Do they have, do they have X number of spotters? Do you have spotting classes? And do they organize it, like, often in areas? Or do you have, is it more random where people just check in? Or let's say, do you have assigned places? There's some place, some of the Skywarn people have, you know, like, places they go to when bad weather hits.
It depends on the situation. Like, basically, if it's just for, like, our county and our area, we have a county coordinator. So when Skywarn's activated, we'll just sit there, give our call sign, and then, you know, then we'll send it and we'll say, well, the weather in my area is such and such. For example, we have pea-sized hail, and winds, say, roughly, we'll say 45-mile-an-hour winds, and some general information like that. Then that way, our county coordinator will pass it on to the National Weather Service. And, of course, the next few minutes after that, you'll see, you know, right on the weather on TV. So that's basically how we do it. And, of course, there's times that we do have classes. I think it's every 3 years they require that we go to a class to keep our Skywarn membership renewed. And we have different numbers, like for this particular area, like myself, my Skywarn number is like November India Mike 008. And Nancy, my other half, hers is November India Mike 009. So when we report our numbers in, as far as, like, if we go direct to the National Weather Service, why, then they would know from that numbers exactly where we are and where we're reporting in from. So we can do it over the internet or, like I said, through our coordinator.
Well, now, let me ask you this question. With ARES and Skywarn working with the National Weather Service, how do you folks have a really good relationship with them? Some areas it's a little stressed, and other areas it's really great. And I'm curious, how do y'all foster that?
Well, I don't think it's really that bad. I mean, we've never had really any issues, so I really can't say that we have really anything to worry about. I mean, everybody I know that's involved, we've had good reports. We've gotten our reports in on time, and it's just, you know, it seems like it's good. I mean, we have several classes throughout the year. You know, it's up on, we have our own county website for Skywarn, so we check on our website for our classes and stuff, as well as we have our own, you know, ARES and RACES for that. So it's not bad. I mean, so far, it's just like one big family. We never have any issues, and so far, we just get along. So I can't complain. Like I said, we have a bunch of good guys and gals out there, and some of them get a little bit nervous, like myself at sometimes, but it all just seems to fall together when we need it.
Let me go slightly in a different direction. In your local club, do you guys have any classes to teach the various exam levels or anything like that? Do you do any of that, or do you do like volunteer testing and that sort of thing?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And as a matter of fact, we have our Wednesday night net for the BARC, which, like I said, the Berks County Amateur Radio Club, or the Berks Amateur Radio Club. Let me correct that. They'll have like similar things like the DX report. They'll always have places within a certain radius, you know, like maybe 25 to 50 mile radius where there's being places tested.
You're listening to the QSL Radio Show, and we'll be right back with our guest Alan Phillips, WA0YAS, right after this. A lot of radio amateurs get a big bang out of building antennas and experimenting, and I think we all do from time to time. But there comes a time when you're just dead serious about making contacts, and you want the antenna to be right. You want it to be a professionally designed, optimized piece of workhorse gear that's going to reach out there and do exactly what you want it to do. And the experimenting's over with. You're serious about operating. You're serious about contesting. You know, you're serious about working satellites or doing moon bounce, or maybe you're going on a de-expedition and you want to put up an array. Now, I'm not talking about a portable antenna. I'm talking about an array. You want to put something on a tower that's big, that works. If you're looking for that kind of an antenna system, there's one place to look, and that's M Squared Antennas. M Squared. Their website is simply M2Inc.com. That's M2, and then Inc.com. M2Inc.com. M Squared Antennas. What you're going to find is HF monobanders. You're going to find HF log periodics. You're going to find HF multibanders, 6-meter antennas, 2-meter antennas, 220 megahertz antennas, 440, 902 to S-band. You're going to find their horizontal Omni, the thing that, boy, I'll tell you what, you're working moon bounce. You want to work moon bounce and you want to work satellites. They've got it knocked. They've got all the EME products you could possibly imagine. They have preamps. They have rotators. They have rotator controls. They've got phasing cables. I mean, they've got it all figured out, including preamps and solid-state amplifiers. Now, if that's what you're into, that's it. I'm telling you, one place to go, M Squared Antennas. Once again, their website is M2Inc.com. That's M followed by the numeral 2 Inc.com. Or you can go to our website, QSLRadioshow.com. Go to their website, take a look around, and you know what? You can pick up the phone and you can call them and ask them questions about what it is you're trying to do, and they'll tell you what you need and they'll work with you. M Squared Antennas. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, "Hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online." I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if say you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSOradioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. This is the QSO Radio Show. And now back to our guest, Alan Phillips, WA0YAS.
As a matter of fact, this year, in August, when we have our mini ham fest in this area for one of the local clubs, which is the Reading Radio Club, they'll even have testing there. Now, I even had been lucky enough as a ARRLVE to sit in and on some of the testing exams, so that's kind of fun as well.
Now, your club is obviously an ARRL affiliation.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And you're a member of the ARRL at this point, or?
Not at this point. I wanted to, but since every time I sit there and think that I'm going to get the chance to be, why, you know, it's always that case. Something comes up that prohibits you from doing it. But, yeah, definitely, at some point, I will be in the near future.
It's amazing the number of people who have league memberships that have expired and they don't even know it. You know, I mean, it's kind of one of those things where some guys join every other year because they forget their membership runs out, and some get, you know, the life membership and whatnot. But I was just kind of curious as to, you know, how do you see the league's interaction with your local club? I mean, do you see, I guess I want to say, how does that all fit together?
Well, actually, I think with what the AARRL has done, I think it's really benefited not only just us locally here, but I think it's benefited us as far as hams all over. Like, for example, with 60 meters at one point until the new law went into effect back in March, why, you know, it'd be fun, it'd be okay to talk with as far as the 50 watts beforehand, but then it would be kind of hard, especially, like, if you have stations from, like, say, Connecticut that you'd be trying to talk to, that, you know, and that's when you almost have to put your ear, like, to the speaker. But the noise would be, sometimes would be so bad that it's like, you'd have to ask the guy to repeat themselves three or four times. But now, in this case, with the new 100-watt rule, you know, for the ERP on 60, why, that's fantastic, because now a lot of people that I have talked to, whether it's in Connecticut or whether it's, like, in Ohio or wherever, it's a whole lot better, because now, since the ARRL has helped with us and the FCC to persuade them to let us have the 100 watts on 60, why, things are a little bit more clear. You can sit there and talk, you know, and understand more, and it just makes and communications a whole lot better. And I think definitely in some type of emergency situation, the 100 watts on 60 meters would work out just fine now. So I like what the AARRL is doing, and I hope they keep it up, because I believe they're really out there to help the amateur radio operator in accomplishing things that need to be done.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, your wife is also a ham. Tell me a little bit about her interest in the hobby. What is she into?
Well, she's basically the same as me. Now, every so often, I'll get her involved in field day, which is a big thing. And again, she always excels. I don't know. I guess it's just something about the female voice that draws the contacts. But she always sit there and tell me, you know, you got to keep moving. You got to keep moving. Don't spend too long on any one frequency or any one band. Get out there and do it. So I've done that. I've gotten more. But basically, she's the same as me, which her call sign is KC0PRO, or she likes to say professional radio operator. She rubs it in. But anyways, hers is basically the same interest. She's like me. She's involved in the Aries Races, Skywarn. A lot of times she'll sit there and she's a little bit nervous about doing the actual emergency drills and stuff that I told you about, but she's going to, in 2013, when we have our next drill for the Olympic Power Station, which is the atomic plant I was telling you about, she's going to finally participate in that and get the idea of it. And it's something because she likes to do it. She loves ham radio as much as I do. It's just that sometimes for her to get on, she has to practically yank the microphone out of my hand.
Oh, man.
Because I could stay on there 24/7 if I didn't have to work. You know, that's how much I love it.
Oh, yeah. And it's a, like you said, though, it's a great, not just a great pastime, but the people you meet on amateur radio and some of the professions that they're in are so unusual. You know, you just don't, you have no idea who you're talking to. And the minute you start rag chewing and exchanging information, all of a sudden it becomes really very, 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 I guess I want to say thought provoking, because you're running into people from all walks of life. And well, tell me about some of the folks you've worked on air, and I guess I want to say some of the most unusual QSOs that maybe stick out in your head.
Well, obviously, I like the Maritime Net. I've talked to people on the Maritime Net, but the thing that one sticks out that really, well, there's two of them actually that stick out really, that really just seem, that just made me flabbergasted. The first one was, I actually got the chance, and this happened to me twice, I got to talk to an aeronautical mobile. The first time was a plane flying from Florida to Puerto Rico to deliver the mail. The second time was, K0DRA, I believe was the call. I forget his name offhand. I think it was John. But he was actually in a jetliner, in a freight liner, and I forget where he was, but he's flying at the altitude of about, I think he said 45,000 feet. So that was pretty neat, and we were able to talk to him, well, I guess, probably a good half hour. So it was kind of fun, and that was on 40 meters. And the first one was, I think, if I remember, on 10 meters. And then the other one that I really had a ball with, and I have to think here for a moment, I was talking to a gentleman in England who had his mobile rig hooked to his bicycle. So that would probably be the most interesting one I had. And he gave me his call sign, which I don't remember offhand, and he said I could look it up on the web to see pictures. And it would show him with his rig on his bicycle, and he would run all over, up and down his city over in England, and you'd see him, like, at the ocean and stuff. And I thought, wow, a ham radio on a bicycle, that is so cool. So that was probably actually the best one that really kind of stuck out at me, when he said about a bicycle mobile. So it's like, wow. So it was kind of nice. So those are probably, like, the two most, the aeronautical mobile and the bicycle one. So those are probably the two really most exciting experiences that when I found that out during the QSOs, that was, like, struck me as wow.
So now your group does put on ham classes then for the newcomers. How do they conduct those? And what, I'm just curious, how many people usually show up for those classes, and how often do they do this?
Actually, at this point, it's once a year, and it depends. Now, I even attended one of her, and I even attended one of them ourselves, and that's when we went to get for our general. So they do it once a year, and they when we went, there's usually been anywhere from, I'd say, maybe 15 to 25 people. And it runs usually about, I think, 6 weeks, if I'm not mistaken, because it will usually start in March and go to, like, maybe through into May or something like that. So it's a pretty long class, and basically, and that's just, you know, for your technician. And then, of course, if you want to upgrade later on, why, there's so many other clubs and stuff around the area where they can go and up study and do their upgrades and other stuff. So it's pretty well organized around this area as far as, you know, anyway, if somebody wants to either get into the hobby or if they're already a technician or whatever and want to upgrade, there's always some place where somebody can go to upgrade their license or for newcomers to start.
Well, tell me a little bit about the area you're in. And what I mean is, like, what in the city you're in, what's the city like, and how would you describe it? Maybe another city you know that's similar to it. And what's the, you know, what's the claim to fame there? What are the big industries? Where do people work in that town?
Okay, well, we're in a little suburb, but the main city right here is called Redding, and it's the county seat. And we have two claims to fame for the city of Redding. Our outlets, which is the Vanity Fair outlets, and there's the, what the heck's the other outlets? The other name slipped my mind just now, but that's one of the claims. The second big claim to fame is Bachman's Pretzels. I don't know if you've heard of Mother out there, you're aware or not, but Bachman's Pretzels and the Vanity Fair outlets, those are like the big thing here in our area. I mean, it's like they claim people have come from New York, Jersey, Delaware, Maryland on these charter buses to shop at our outlets. So it's kind of fun, and I would say there's probably maybe in the city and the suburbs, somewhere around maybe 50 to 55,000 people altogether. So it's a nice little metropolitan area.
So how many people are members of your club? I mean, how many people are in the Ham Radio Club?
Oh, God, last time I seen, I'd say probably in one of them, probably about maybe 100 or so, and in the other one, probably about the same in each of them. For this area, there's probably about a minimum of 100 in each club.
So you have two amateur radio clubs there, then?
Yeah.
And that happens in some areas. Sometimes they just start up separately. Sometimes there's one club, and they split, and they go different directions. And of course, usually when that happens, it's just a matter that people have different interests, you know, so they go in different directions. And then sometimes they get together and combine the clubs to do different things. So, but that's interesting that you have two clubs in that city with about 100 members each. That's pretty good. You know, one of the things that I want to get into talking to you about, and this goes, I mean, it really fits with amateur radio. So if you're sitting down, We're going to start talking about something that maybe that you've never heard talked about in the way that we're going to approach it. Now, you may have seen all these television programs and whatnot, but there's a bunch of folks out there that are into the investigation of paranormal activities and utilizing a lot of electronics to do that. And so I'm just going to ask you to kind of tell me what got your interest in this. What got you thinking about it?
Well, basically, to start out, I'm Western Cherokee background. I have Western Cherokee blood in me, and my mom always taught us. I was raised; she raised five of us, single handed, single parents. So, God bless her, man. She did a heck of a job with us. But anyhow, we were always taught that there's life in all things, whether it's a tree, whether it's a rock. You know, Mother Earth, everything on Mother Earth had life. So that was the start of it, and then I guess what made me really start getting into it was the one day my mom was making French fries. Now we had in our house we had like the old stoves, you know, the old gas stoves with the white enamel and the little, I guess you could say, the old porcelain sink knobs type looking things, you know.
Oh yeah.
So
mm-hmm.
Anyhow, she was sitting there and she was making French fries, and I guess I don't know if it was the fact that she didn't think she had them dry enough or whatever, but this big ball of fire just like rose up out of the skillet and it just hit the ceiling and poof, there wasn't no mark or anything. And my mom kind of sat there and kind of took that as some kind of sign of something. So for the longest time, she was like kind of cautious, and she'd always tell us, you know, be careful, blah, blah, blah. And that kind of started me. Now, what really kind of made things click as well is I've always been into science. I mean, I'm a total science buff. I could sit there and tear anything apart just to find out why it works, what makes it work, the whole nine yards. I mean, I would sit there at 8 years old, and I'd take my mom's old the toasters we'd have, which at that time we graduate from the type where you put the bread in and then close the sides to where it just popped out. But I'd tear them apart, and there's a couple times I blew fuses, but there's times I didn't. But I'd tear it apart just to see how it worked, and then I'd try to put it back together. If it didn't work, just make it work. Sometimes I was successful, and like I said, sometimes I wasn't. So that's another reason that I guess I got involved at ham radio. And from there, you know, we just started with the more modern-day gadgets like some of the people see on TV and stuff. But I can say it's not always as glamorous as you see on these shows. There's a lot more than what people see on TV that's involved in that kind of stuff, in paranormal activities and investigations.
Well, you know, I guess I want to say I've had a little experience with it myself. And I think the most amazing thing was having one of these K2 meters. Now, we had taken this thing into a place where there was no electricity, and we were far enough away from everything to where there was no RF radiation going on in the area. And the fellow that we were with, actually, he was a minister, and he began to talk, you know, and converse with, you know, what you would consider to be, you know, spirit entities or whatever in the room. And that crazy meter just started flashing on and off. He'd ask a question, and the thing would flash. You know, I thought, I don't believe this. This is you know, this is just incredible. So, but it's electronic. So, why don't we talk a little bit about this thing they call the K2 meter, EMF meter? What's in those things, and what makes them work? Do you? I mean, have you ever had one apart, or you ever tried to build one, or anything like that?
Well, the only thing I've ever done so far with the one I have is I replaced the battery. But I do know they have a little circuit board in there with diodes and the resistors and the little coils and capacitors and all that. And basically what I've seen is somehow they have this all connected. Now, like I said, I haven't torn apart. I mean, the cheapest one, I think it's like $60. So, you know, we try and preserve the equipment. But anyhow, they're connected to these little diodes, these lights, the LEDs, I guess you want to call them. And there's like two sets of each color. So I guess it comes out to like six colors or something, or three sets of colors, because there's like two green, and there's like, if I'm not mistaken, two yellow, and then two red. Now, the belief in the paranormal world is that as the entity or the spirit gets closer, of course, the spirit draws to send off electromagnetic energy. So the belief is that as the spirit gets closer, it will light these lights up brighter. For example, it could walk in front of it and real close and make them go all the way up to the red, you know, and then go back down after it passes by. Or they could be at a distance coming towards it, and as they slowly come towards it, then it will go and gradually light up to the whole thing light up. And we've had some experience with them as well. I mean, we've been, like you said, we've been in places to where it's, as far as any kind of electricity or RF energy or whatever, totally dead. I mean, and these things, all of a sudden, I'd sit there and say, okay, is there anybody here that will, you know, like to communicate, talk to us, and tell us a little bit about themselves or whatever, and boom, these things go like crazy. And always, we always, when we do this stuff, you know, we always have our client, per se, to go around and show us the so-called paranormal hotspots, you know. And a lot of times we find that not only are they in the paranormal hotspots, but sometimes they like to play, for lack of a better term, hide-and-seek. There's been places we've come up with stuff on some of our investigations that we never thought that would happen. And I mean, and that's usually the places where we've gotten a lot of activity, where we least suspect it. So we've done that with the K2. We've got other methods. I mean, we even have what they call the ghost meter, which I think you can, depending on where you go online, you can pay about $30 for it, which is a nice little toy, and it's relatively inexpensive if somebody would ever want to start. You know, it's not going to cost them an arm and leg. But it's just a little needle, bounces up, analog needle, by the way, bounces up and down, and it makes a little beeping sound, and you got two little red LED lights to flash. Of course, it does that when you first turn it on, but then you go around like we do before we go into any investigation. We get a base reading for the electromagnetic field or any kind of RF or anything that could cause something, you know, normally to make it happen. Now, we don't go to, as some teams would do, to debunk, as they say.
You're listening to the QSO Radio Show, and we'll be right back with our guest, Alan Phillips, WA0YAS, right after this. Week after week, you hear us talk about Trans World Antennas, and you hear us talk about the TW2010, the 4040, the Backpacker, and all these different antennas. Of course, the TW2010 Adventurer came first. Folks were amazed at its performance. Then they introduced the Backpacker, and now the 4040. Go to EHAM and read the reviews on the TW2010. Just go to EHAM and read those reviews. Now, you can do that by going to transworldantennas.com. Just go to transworldantennas.com. Transworld Antennas, one word. Go to transworldantennas.com. There's a link on that page that'll take you right straight to the EHAM reviews, or you can just go to EHAM yourself. And if you're a ham, you know how to get to EHAM on the internet. Just Google it. You'll get there. And read the reviews. See what other amateur radio operators are saying about this antenna. Thank you.
When I first got into ham radio, one of the things I think that plagued me, that plagues a lot of hams, and that's soldering. Gosh, it just seemed like I could never get my soldering to look like what you see coming out of the factory. And I always wondered why that was. And I got pretty good at it, but then later on, I ran into a radio engineer in the Nashville area that said, you need to go get you a Hakko. And I said, a what? He said, a Hakko. Go get a Hakko soldering station. And I'd seen these things, and I felt, well, I thought they were some sort of a high-dollar item, you know, and I just, you know, I'd buy my soldering my soldering sticks or my soldering station at, you know, Ace Hardware or someplace, you know, and never paid a whole lot for them. And that's one of the reasons why I think my soldering looks so bad. But I found out the Hakko really was not an expensive thing. Very, very affordable. So I got my first 936 back years ago, and I'm still using it. It's on my workbench today, and I carry one with me. I carry a 936 with me everywhere I go. And there's absolutely nothing like it. Now, if you tried to solder, you've had problems with cold solder joints. The tip won't heat up consistently and evenly. You're constantly having, you know, inconsistent problems with solder flow and all that kind of thing. You just need a Hakko. The one that I recommend right now is the Hakko FX888. That's the Hakko FX888 soldering station. And I'm telling you, it's a different world. You put a Hakko on your bench. Boy, if we'd have had those things when we were building Heath kits years ago, it would have made a huge difference. But today, with the experimenters, people building kits, or even when you're working on something or trying to service something, you absolutely have to have a good quality soldering tool, or, you know, it's just not going to happen. Now, they make desoldering tools, they make soldering tools, they have a whole complete line of everything you can imagine. And the website is just simply HakkoUSA.com. That's Hakko, HakkoUSA.com. That's HakkoUSA.com. HakkoUSA.com. Now, if you look at the front page of our website, QSOradioshow.com, there's a link to Hakko, and I'd invite each and every one of you to go up there and take a look at that. And if you do any soldering at all, and even if you don't and you think someday you may, you need a Hakko. And I recommend the Hakko FX888 for, I would say, 80% of most amateur radio work. Thank you so much. Here at the QSO Radio Show, we really need to hear from you. Go to our website, simply QSOradioshow.com. That's QSOradioshow.com. And you'll see all the past podcasts up there and other information. But go to the part where it says email Ted and send us an email. And be sure and put on that email, I want to win, because always giving something away. Go to the website. It's simply QSOradioshow.com and send us an email. And while you're at it, be sure and friend us on Facebook, QSO Radio Show, and follow us on Twitter, QSO Radio Show. And thank you for listening. This is the QSO Radio Show. And now back to our guest, Alan Phillips, WA0YAS.
It's been disproved, but we just go in to collect the evidence and go through it and find out. Yes, there is, or yes, there is, or no, there isn't. But anyhow, back to that meter, why, we'll go all through all this. We sit there and take various infrared thermometers and get readings of various areas. We even have similar stuff like mini DDRs where we set up. We put, like, I got a 4-gigabyte SD card I pop in there, and we'll set it up and walk away, which, depending on where we're at, we can put a little alarm in it that will sound if something comes near, because it's, you know, it's also motion activated. So we have all kinds of little goodies, but some of our favorites, like I said, the EMF meter, the RF meter, and of course like we were just talking about, the good old K2, and now they've got so many versions of that now. Why they're constantly evolving and, you know, doing something to just about everything.
Well, you know, my son Matt had taken a camera, a TV camera, and I don't know what he did. He went inside of it and removed, I guess would be the infrared filter on it, and put it all back together again. And then with an infrared light source, that thing would show everything up and under the sun in the dark. And then they used it, just a couple of folks used it on some sort of doing paranormal investigations. So have you ever used an infrared camera? I know I've also seen these things they use called infrared imagers, which, you know, you aim that into a totally dark room, and if there's somebody standing in there, you can see their outline. And, I mean, it's gotten that sophisticated. I don't know if you've ever used anything like that at all.
Oh, yeah, we have. As a matter of fact, my assistant director and my friend, his name's Mike, he has an actual filter, an actual genuine infrared filter that he can put on his camera to where if you're taking a picture and you look into the viewfinder, it's totally black. But yet, when you take the picture and you look at it after, you know, later on, while you can see the images in infrared, which it's a true infrared filter, we have what they call a full spectrum camera that covers everything from the low end of the light spectrum, which is your infrared, all the way through to the visible light that we see with our eyes, as well as the ultraviolet light. So, and there's been a lot of things we've gotten on the ultraviolet portion, which is the upper end of the light spectrum as well, that we've seen. So, you know, if you can combine all them, you know, your infrared as well as your ultraviolet light, then you'll even get more with the ultraviolet than you will with the infrared. And we, an example of that, and maybe I get a chance to get into this later on, but on our ghost hunting website, which our team's Ghost Hunters Incorporated, and we'll get into a little more detail about that if I have the time and everybody wants to hear it. But we have some pictures up of some of the stuff. And the one picture where we were using the actual infrared lens that I told you about, and this is like where you can screw it into the camera. This was on an Olympus. We were at a cabin on what used to be a 1700s homestead, which it's still there, and they started restoring it. So now, again, back to community service, we're helping the family who owns all this property that this homestead was on to restore the cabin, restore the other parts of it, and hopefully someday get it on the National Register of Historical Places. But again, Mike, he was out with his camera, and he took a picture into the cabin from the back door with the infrared. And now everybody can be their judge, but when we looked at the picture, it looked like what we thought maybe could have been an Indian, of course, because at this time it was up in the area where the Iroquois and the Seneca Indian were teaming with the British to, you know, supposedly reclaim their land from the white settlers. But that's what we think. Now, we've seen other people that we've had, they say, oh, my God, it looks like an Indian, and we never told them this stuff, so maybe there is something to it. But what makes it unique is where we see this image in this infrared picture, the window frames in this window are totally missing. I mean, there's not any glass pane anywhere. So that's what made it unusual. So, you know, and they can see that stuff. And we were looking, and this is broad daylight. So we're like, whoa. And I even said, Mike, did you even see that when you looked through the viewfinder? He said, no. I didn't see anything, just the window. I said, well, you know, this is kind of interesting. So, and there's other groups that we have that we send it around, you know, we kind of interact with each other, and we say, well, what do you think of this? And they'll send us stuff, and, well, what do you think of that? And we'll kind of give each other what we think, and it's pretty much on the same wavelength as the old saying goes. So that's when we use the infrared. Now, we have some camcorders, which are made especially for infrared to record videos, and we also have anything where the light's too dark or there's not enough light, we have infrared illuminators that we can put on it, which obviously increase that. So we have them out there, and the best thing that I found as far as for something like that is any infrared camera, whether you can modify it yourself or if you spend a couple dollars for one, or any cameras or camcorder that, like I said earlier, has the full spectrum capability. So they're good. They're one of the better tools out there as compared to the old days of paranormal investigating.
Okay, now let me just ask a question here. You know, there's a myriad of electronic devices that are being used for this now. Like, for example, have you ever seen one of these things called an ovulus?
Oh, Oh yeah, I've heard them. Yeah.
Okay. Now, for the folks that are listening, yes, this is the QSO radio show, all about ham radio, and we're talking to WA0YAS, Alan Phillips. He is in Pennsylvania, and not only is he a radio amateur, but he's also involved in paranormal investigations. And of course, a lot of what's being used today is electronics. Now, this this thing called an ovulus has a word vocabulary in it. In other words, it's already got all these different words programmed. I don't know how many words. Do you know how many words they put in that thing? I mean, it's like a whole.
It's like, if I'm not mistaken, I think it's anywhere up to like 5,000 words, somewhere in there.
There's a bunch, yeah. And
there's a lot, yeah, definitely a lot.
I don't know what they use to trigger it, okay? In other words, there's something triggers it almost on a random basis. It requires something to happen for it to speak one of these words that's in its vocabulary. I don't know what trips it. I mean, I've never seen a schematic of the thing. I have no idea what's there. But there's all these, you know, another thing, too, we're doing this. We're talking about all this on the about ham radio and whatnot. I'll tell you what, I think the hams, amateur radio operators, could go crazy creating ghost hunting devices, you know, things that could be, messed with by the supposed paranormal world. But anyways, this ovulus, when you take it into a place, you know, what they're counting on is something triggering it and being able to control that vocabulary to speak a certain word. And I've actually seen this thing work to where it was spooky. In other words, they would take it into a place where somebody had died or whatever, and out of the clear blue sky, because you can't make it say anything. In other words, it's going to do whatever it's going to do. There's no way to control it.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah. And all of a sudden, it would come up with a word, Mary. It would just say Mary, you know, and then it might say scared, you know. And then you find out that the lady that died's name was Mary, and she was murdered, you know, or something along that line. And it's like, I mean, it's in a... I think there's probably a lot of things the ovulus could say that you could attribute to something. In other words, you could stretch it far enough to where, oh, wow, did you hear that? You know, but it's really kind of uncanny when I've seen the things demonstrated. Now, have you ever worked with one, or have you ever seen it demonstrated? Did it seem to work, or did it just talk gibberish?
Well, I've seen it demonstrated. As a matter of fact, I know a guy that has a team out in Colorado, in California. I think it's Silver Spurs, Colorado, or something like that. But his team's called Ghost Rider Investigations, and he's used it. As a matter of fact, him and I both, at several occasions, we have our own internet radio talk show pertaining to paranormal. And we've been guests on each other's show. And, he's used it several times to do like a, I guess you could say, like a medium thing for guests to call in and stuff. And he seems to have success with it. Now, me, on the other hand, I've never really used it, but we do use something similar, which a lot of people would know as either Frank's Box or the Ghost Box. I don't know if you guys have ever heard of them or not.
Oh, yeah.
It works similar to basically on the same principle as the ovulus. And for the listeners who probably wonder what the heck we're talking about, basically what the Ghost Box is, it's a little modified radio, which you can get from Radio Shack. Now, we have two of them on our team. One is the Radio Shack 12-497, and the other one is the Radio Shack 12-470. Now, the only difference between the two is the 12-479, yeah, I'll get it right here, you need a speaker for. The other one has a speaker built in, and what we have done with these radios, we have taken a little pin that's in there from the clipboard. We'll open it up, we'll remove the circuit board. Of course, we'll gently pull these little pins off, and we'll snip the pin off. Now, what it does, when you snip this pin, it allows the radio to scan through the frequencies, whether it's AM frequency or FM frequency. Some of them even have weather frequencies on TV. But when you move this pin off, that's what it allows to do. And it's the same with the 470. Now they got the 587, which you just bend the pin down, and then you put it back together. But basically, the theory behind this is you're creating something like a background noise. I don't know, there used to be a TV show out years ago called White Noise, where they used the TV, which it's the same principle as that. And what this is supposed to do, and we've had some pretty good results with it as well, is the person you're contacting is able to use the electromagnetic field from this white noise to vocalize things. Now, in one case, we were doing, it was a private charity organization, and due to our confidentiality policy, I can't name names, but we were there, and on the third floor, they had like four floors. Two of the floors were like disarrayed apartments. But at some point, they used it for to help the people to live there and stuff. But anyways, we were there, and Mike turned around, and they had told us that the founder of this particular chapter of the organization, they called her Aunt Jo. So Mike turns around, and he goes, "Is there anybody here with you, Aunt Jo?" And we had distinct, just as sure as you can hear Ted and I, and we can hear each other, and all the listeners can hear us, we heard a female voice say, "No, it's just me." Now, what made that amazing is it was over several different sweeps of the FM band. Now, obviously, you know, if you're scanning something like that, you'll be able to hear it. Now, in this case, if we were out in the middle of nowhere where basically there was no radio station strong enough to interfere. So it takes a little practice. You have to learn to be able to discern, yes, this was a radio station or this was somebody in regards to something on a radio station. So it takes a little practice. You just can't sit there, "Oh, we got something," you know, the first night out. But that's what we've had luck. We've had luck with them quite a few times. Some of the other things we do is we use the little mini mag lights. Of course, dowsing rods, we've used them and got some real interesting results. So if it's out there and we can get it for our team, we're going to test it. We used what they call parabolic mics, the whole nine yards.
Okay, now let's talk about old Frank's box here for a second, okay?
Okay.
I've seen these devices, and the fellow that Frank Sumption, I guess is the guy's name, that actually came up with this concept. And I'll re-explain, because the one I saw was basically for the AM radio band. And it would scan like every 5 kc, maybe it would stop. It would, you know,
yeah,
so
I think it was something like that. Yeah,
it would stop every 5 kc's, going flip 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 flip, and you would hear bits and pieces of voices coming in, which were basically radio stations, you know. So I asked the question. I said, "Well, if that's the case, why would you make the ghost chase up and down the dial? Why wouldn't you just park it on one frequency, and then they could talk on the one frequency?" I'm just, you know, skeptic, you know. And also being a radio engineer, it's a little hard for me to accept the fact, because when I hear one of those things, all I hear is the stations, you know. I mean, all I hear are those stations
yeah.
coming in. But then a friend of ours took it out to a place and got on talking to this whatever entity it was, and started asking questions. And all of a sudden, these voices started coming out of there that did not match up with what I would consider to be a conventional radio broadcast, you know. And I thought, now this is weird, you know. It's, you know, because I don't know. To me, it just seems like if something was going to communicate, it would stand a better chance if you parked it on one frequency rather than having it scanning up and down the dial with radio stations. Now, I don't know. What do you think about that? What's your opinion of that?
Well, we tried it both ways, and so far at this point, it seems like it works better with the scanning. But we have at times both on the AM as well as the FM bands sit there and find a clear FM frequency, you know, and we'll let it sit there and do its thing. But for some reason, to this point, we haven't had that much luck. It's mostly been when it's scanning, like you said, over either maybe 5, 10 megahertz or on the AM band, 5 KCs or whatever on the AM band. So that's where we got most of our luck. But we're always trying something, you know. We're out there. We experiment with so many different things because we're all, like any other paranormal investigation team or even any other amateur radio operator, you're always looking to improve your equipment, whether it's amateur radio or paranormal investigating equipment. So, you know, that's basically why we do it. And if we find something that works, we work with it, but then we still leave ourselves open to other options. So we're always trying something new every investigation.
With the Frank's box, though, let's think about that for a minute. Do you think maybe what you're hearing on the Frank's box is bits and pieces of people talking that are part of radio programming content? In other words, as it's going up the dial, you know, you catch some newscaster going in Boston, you know, and then the next one was, you know, there's another news story up the dial on another news station, and they're talking about some guy, Sam, you know, and it goes across. I mean, do you think that that's what you're really hearing? Is it possible that all you're really hearing is just the voices coming across that are on the broadcast band on the various channels, especially on AM, skipping in from out of state? I mean, I'd like to know your opinion, because, see, you got a ham license,
And you know the electronics end of it. And the Frank's box thing is something that I have just scratched a hole in my head thinking to myself, is it possible this thing could really work? You know, or is it just, you know, people, overactive imaginations, you got this thing on and it's scanning up the dial and it's catching bits and pieces of voices from various radio stations and a person sitting there in contemplation. So it seems as though that you're getting a message from the beyond. I don't know. How do you see that?
Well, you know, I've thought about that myself, Ted, and I'm probably one of the biggest skeptics on our team. I mean, our whole team's skeptic, but, you know, we go in with that attitude, and we review our evidence and stuff that we capture with the same attitude, but yet we all believe. But the way I look at it, yeah, there could be some truth to that, to where somebody, if they're kind of a greenhorn, as they say, with the Frank's box or the ghost box, whichever they choose to call it, to where they're going to sit there and, you know, they're sitting there and they're in a so-called haunted environment, quote, end quote. And they're you know, they're anticipating the excitement of some kind of reply. And, yes, it's possible that they could hear bits and pieces of the radio station in their mind, put this together to say, well, this says this and this. But what we have found, we get when we ask a direct question, like I said earlier, when Mike sat there and said, is there anybody else here with you, Aunt Jo? And you hear, no, it's just me, come over several different cases, like with the AM, you hear this over, say, maybe 50 KCs, okay? So you're, instead of just hearing bits and pieces where you might hear every 5, 10 KCs, you're hearing this over, say, like 50 KCs. So you're hearing this whole sentence, and it's not broken. And plus, you're getting a direct response to a question. So when we hear something like that, then we feel that we're getting a direct response to a direct question.
Well, if I heard that, I'd be convinced. You know, I really would.
Well, it kind of got our attention real quick. That's for dog answer.
Yeah, especially if you're familiar with the broadcast band and whatnot. I'll tell you, as a friend of mine sent me a little radio here. It's called ITC Research Device. You ever heard of those?
Yeah, I've heard of, they have a lot of research stuff like that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, anyways, he sent this thing to me. And he told me, he says, this is what is known as a Frank's box. Okay, so I said, well, you know, how do you use it and how does it work? And so he sent this thing to me, and I'm going to push the button and hold it up to the speaker just so people can hear what this thing kind of sounds like when it's sweeping. If I can figure out how to run it, let's see here. Yeah, here we go. Now I'm close into some computers. So the computers in here are whistling, oscillating in the middle of the radio.
Yeah.
But that's about what they sound like, except when they land on stations. And this is, well, that's in the middle of the AM broadcast band, but the problem is, of course, I'm surrounded by computers here. So, but now let's leave Frank's box alone for a minute and move on to, have you ever heard of a gentleman by the name of Constantine, I don't know which way it is, Rodive? R-A-U...
The name sounds familiar.
R-A-U...
Sounds familiar, I'm not sure, though.
D-I-V-E. Well, here's what he did, and the results for this were surprising. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, this is the QSO radio show here. I just imagine people tuning this thing in and saying, what in the world are they talking about? What is this? You know? And with me here is... I guess I'm going to call him today. I'm going to have to call him my partner in crime, W-A-0-Y-A-S, Alan Phillips. And we are talking ham radio, but we're also talking about the fact that this gentleman is into a hobby that has increased and has become literally epidemic. Not only are there a bunch of television shows that cover it, but I mean, there are groups springing up all over the country, and all of the devices they use are basically electronics, with the exception of very few. Like, you're talking about dowsing rods. I mean, and that's about the only thing I can think of, you know, that's, unless somebody's carrying a Ouija board. You know, but anyways, this thing, the Constantine Rodive, what he did was he took a diode, an IN34A or similar thereof, like what you'd have in a crystal radio, and connected it, somehow coupled it like a crystal radio, but broadband. In other words, so it would cover, it was not tuned, it was just untuned. with a very short antenna and fed it directly to the audio input of a recorder. And with that, he recorded myriads of voices that he claimed just came out of the ether. Now, a lot of people, I'm sure, would say, well, you know, that was probably, he was probably picking up radio stations. Well, not really. I mean, he would, you know, the antenna on this thing was only like 2 inches long or something, or 3 or 4 inches long. And the voices were actual voices. I mean, you would hear the recordings that he made, unless, of course, he was a fraud. So anyways, I experimented a little bit with one of those, and I was actually able to pick up a few voices here and there that I couldn't really explain. But I was wondering if you'd ever seen those things. And all they use is an IN34A diode, and I don't know how they couple it into the recorder. I mean, I don't know if they build it up like a crystal radio and have a load resistor on it and all that kind of stuff. I just don't know. I suppose if you built a crystal radio up and put a very, very short antenna and coupled it into an audio amplifier, you would have what would be then known as a Rodive detector. Once again, that's spelled Raudive. Actually, some of these folks, they sell those on eBay, but I would think a ham could build that in a heartbeat. So,
absolutely. Yeah.
So I was wondering, have you ever heard of those things? Have you ever?
Yeah, I have. We haven't got a chance to use them. As a matter of fact, it's funny you were mentioning that, because another thing that a lot of people don't know is Thomas Edison, the founder of the light bulb, was also experimenting for stuff to quote unquote listen to the spirit realm, if you will. And he had one device that supposedly that he never really got to put into use. But, he claimed he was able to hear voices as well and actually communicate. What the heck do they call that now? Gosh, I forget what it was, but I even read it in a book. And
Edison was at some like a press conference or something and made reference to this thing, you know. And other folks that worked with him at Menlo Park had spoken about something that he was working on, although I think it was kept pretty hush. I mean, it wasn't something that was openly discussed amongst the public at all.
And I know it, and like I said, I forget what they call it now, something phone or something. But it was kept pretty hushed to the point to where even after his passing, people were wondering if it really existed. And this is big. Now, this is a lot of things that people don't know. And now, I've had on our internet radio show, which, like I said, was Ghost Radio, a gentleman, his name was Terrence Aime, that had wrote this book, which mentioned all these kind of different things in it, called Mysteries of the Multiverse, which, wow, that book has a really good concept and really makes you think. But that's where I first read about this. It's like, wow, Edison back was experimenting, even back in his day, with spirit communications from beyond. It's like, wow, this is fantastic. But
I'd like to invite amateur radio operators, because I think about this for a minute. You may not want to believe in ghosts or the supernatural, but you know, you hear people like Michio Kaku get on and talk about parallel universes and interdimensional things, you know, that they're talking about now as if it were, you know, common everyday knowledge. You know, the Hadron Collider, they're talking about the fact that they're looking for the God particle, you know. And if they, all this stuff. So, you know, we really don't know that much about, you know, we don't know what we're dealing with. I mean, we really don't know. We don't know what a ghost is. We think we do. I mean, we think it's a spirit. And I know with your Cherokee background, or is it Cherokee? Are you? I think you said you were Cherokee. Were you not? Or
yeah, Cherokee. Yeah.
Okay. Well, your Cherokee background, you've probably got a very rich history in your family of stories and things that have to do with ancestors and spirits and how they relate to the earth and all that kind of thing. I mean, because that's the line they go down. But I mean, I would say with an open mind, and I would say that hams ought to take an interest in creating things, creating devices, you know, and doing a little investigation, you know, on their own. One thing I discovered as a kid is I drove 2 10-foot copper rods into the ground, and off of those rods I came out, and I went through an audio transformer into the input of an audio amplifier. And I'm telling you, the sounds that you would hear coming out of that thing would scare you. I have no idea. I assume we were hearing, you know, layers of rock doing a piezoelectric type effect or something, generating electricity, which then was, you know, that would come across as sound. But I mean, there's just so much unknown that you just don't know, you know. And how many dimensions are there? We don't know. I mean, I guess they say now, what is it? What is the count? They say that they've the the scientists and physicists that are into string theory and all this are saying, how many universes are there? That they're saying that they have definitely proven that there's these parallel universes. I don't know. It's, you know, it's difficult to exist or to think about that you exist in X number of universes. It's bad enough just in one.
That would be strange and weird. Another me, oh my God.
Yeah. But I mean, I'm just saying, keep an open mind in this as we're talking about this. What about, now, okay, we talked about the ovulus. We've talked about the Frank's box thing. I brought up the Constantine Rodive, the Rodive detector. And there's a book, incidentally, that he wrote called Breakthrough, if you can find it somewhere. It's an interesting read. And they've actually got a diagram in there for this Rodive detector. But the other thing is the world of electronic voice phenomena, they call it, EVP. And a person doesn't really need anything extraordinary to participate in the recording and gathering of these EVPs. Tell me a little bit about your group and what you use to capture EVP and what EVP is. And, just start in and tell us about it.
Okay, well, first of all, I'll start out by saying we originally started long before the ghost hunting craze, if you will. Our group was started back in 1974 in Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, a little place called Pottstown, which is where I grew up at. Part, you know, in my latter years, as in my early to late teens and early 20s and stuff. But anyhow, back in them days, as far as EVPs, we started out, and I'm sure there's a lot of listeners that will remember these, and probably a few that won't, but the good old portable cassette, which was like, what, maybe 6 inches long, and you had like 3 inches wide, and you carry it with this little handle. So that was one of the ways we did our EVPs. Of course, for variances in temperature, why we had the good old hand, you know, oh, there's a cold spot. No, this is warm enough, of course. For the good old place of the EMF meter or the K2 meter, whichever one would choose to use, we had the old compass and watching the fluctuations in the needle. But as far as the EVPs, what we do nowadays is we have digital voice recorders. Now, it don't matter if it's digital. I mean, some people will use these little, like the dictation machines with the micro mini cassettes. So it really don't matter. It's basically your taste, what you prefer to carry around in your pocket or in your equipment or however. But we like the digital voice recorders. Now, the ones we would recommend would be the Olympus. And, of course, one of my personal favorites is the RCA. Now, it's been set for the better quality so you don't get the noise from whatever it is in the digital voice recorders turning, as well as the old-fashioned cassette tapes, to use an external microphone. But we've had no problems with the digital voice recorders. And what we try to do is when the clients will give us a little bit of what they feel is going on, and if they have any names, like with the charity organization, they had names, and they filled us in a little bit. So we would use the information they give us, as well as the research information that we've done on the property and stuff, to see what was going on. If we come up with names, we'd say, okay, we know so-and-so's here. Can you let us know you're here by, you know, saying hi to us or whatever? Well, obviously, depending on how many hours, like some of our investigations can last from a minimum of 4 to 8 hours. I mean, there's been times we've come home and just pulling in, or actually just leaving an investigation, and something's coming up. But anyhow, so if you had, go ahead.
So I'm just laughing. I know the feeling.
Okay. So anyhow, obviously, as you know, for every hour of video you have, for every hour of audio, whether it's an EVP or whatever the case may be, you got to review this. So you're figuring if you have three digital voice recorders running, and most of these are running basically eight hours at a shot, then there's like 24 hours of audio good to go through. Now, in our case right now, we have four cameras, infrared cameras that we use to our digital video recorder, which it's in a camera system, but we can use them either hardwired or wireless. But so you figure, if you're doing like with them, if you do 4 hours of an investigation time, right there's what four, where there's what 16 hours, somewhere there of video. You got, so you have to go through all this stuff and you have to be able to sort what's what, and you have to know what's going on. Like, did so-and-so, if you see light come on and off in a basement, for example, did somebody do something with the electricity to where that light did that? I mean, it's a whole thing. But then it's the same thing with the digital voice recorders. You have to sit there and try and discern, well, was this a footstep by somebody moving through something, or was this an actual response to a question we asked? And what we try to do with our digital voice recorders, if somebody like is whispering in the background, we'll say, okay, that was so-and-so whispering, asking a question, or we try and identify that sound, or somebody came into the room. So this way, when we listen to it, we know that was man-made noise. So anything other than that we hear other than man-made, we sit there and it's like, we get thinking, well, is this paranormal? Now, some of the things I found, myself as an investigator, as well as the rest of our team, will be going through our EVP evidence. And what really happens is, if we ask a direct question, now sometimes, a lot of times, we use what they call wave pad, which is an audio thing to where, you know, you can see the little lines, you can break it down, listen to it in stereo and watch it, or in some cases, if you want to edit it, which we don't, we just amplify any sounds and we clean up like this and hum in it. But I look for the finer spots where you sit there and think, well, gee, there's nothing in here. And most of the times I found it, and there'll be direct answers to our questions, and it's really amazing. Like, wow. Like, one place we were on, we asked, what year is it? And we hear 1878.
You know, and what's amazing, okay. and folks may think this is all imaginary or trumped up, but we went to a place where we actually, my two sons and I, we used to work there, and I'll tell you, it was a place out in just outside of Lebanon, Tennessee, called Cedar Vine Manor, and we were in there, and some folks wanted us to come out and help do an investigation there, you know, so we decided, well, we'll go on out and see, you know, what we can contribute or whatever. And we were in the kitchen trying to find some coffee, of all things, at 2 o'clock in the morning, because there was all these bun coffee makers in there, and we used to work there, so there used to be just tons of coffee in the place, so you could always find a bag of coffee to throw in a maker, you know, and make a pot of coffee. So my son David's in there, and he's looking around trying to find a little thing, a Maxwell House or Folgers or something, you know, make a pot of coffee because everybody's going to sleep. And we heard some noises. We didn't know what they were. And the little pocket recorder was being carried in a pocket. And it was one of the, probably an Olympus or something along that line. And when we got back and plugged it into the USB on the computer and opened it up in Adobe Audition, there was clearly, at one point where we heard the noise, clearly a little pattern there. And so we went over to that pattern and kind of highlighted it. And hit the play button, and there was a voice, a woman's voice, and she clearly is saying, get out of my kitchen, okay? I mean, there was nobody around like that. And what threw me off was the fact that that was a renovated old barn. It was an old barn, and it was a Civil War convalescent home kind of thing. But the old barn in back had been renovated into a event facility, so there was never an old lady in charge of it. I mean, it was always the chef who was there until they finally, the place got closed down. I guess somebody else has bought it now, and it's under a different name, but there was never anybody there like that, see? So this voice was just totally unexplained. I mean, I could understand if, you know, that, you know, years ago, if there had been a kitchen there, but there wasn't. It was an old barn, you know? So, I mean, but there was clearly a voice there, and you can't deny it. I mean, this is clear as can be, a lot clearer than what you hear on these television programs. And there was nobody in there yelling, get out of my kitchen, you know. So, I don't know. I mean, the stuff comes through, and you wonder, where does it come from? I guess I was going to say, you ask a question, what year is it? You got a year response. What have been some of the other questions you've asked, and what kind of responses have you got?
Okay, well, let me give you one. I could give you a couple, but one of the better ones.
You're listening to the QSO Radio Show, and we'll be right back with our guest, Alan Phillips, WA0YAS, right after this. One of the things we noticed at the Dayton Hamvention 2012 was the number of people that came up to the QSO radio booth and said, hey, I got my ticket by studying with Ham Test Online. My wife got her license through studying with Ham Test Online. My son got his ticket. All of my kids got their tickets with Ham Test Online. I mean, it went on and on and on. And there's a reason why. I mean, I've looked at all different kinds of study materials for getting your ham ticket. And either
there's a rule, they're either cram sessions where you just memorize the answers, or they're so technical that you can get the ticket providing you want to study for the rest of your life. But Ham Test Online is kind of a perfect blend of that. In other words, they teach you. You actually learn the material. They give you pictures, simple descriptions, however. Rather than a book that rambles on and on and on and on about something, it's concise. It's to the point. It's where your mind can grasp it. And then when you see that question come around again on the test, you're ready for it because you've got a brief overview. I mean, you don't know all the technical implications of some mathematical formula, but you have a good idea on the concept, I want to say, of how something works or operates. Therefore, you know how to pick the right answer. Now, if, say, you're studying and you get the wrong answer, it will feed you back that question again and again and again. And finally, you can't help but learn it. You can go up to Ham Test Online and literally spend hours if you wish, and it doesn't bore you. You don't feel like you're not yawning like reading into a book or listening to a tape recording or something. It's a very unique experience. If you know someone that you'd like to see get their ticket, give them a gift certificate. Give them a membership to Ham Test Online. If you want to upgrade and get the next license up, enroll with Ham Test Online. Don't fool around. Don't waste your time. The technician ticket's only around $20 for like 2 years. You can't miss. Go to their website. It's so simple. HamTestOnline.com. That's HamTestOnline.com. This is the QSO Radio Show. And now back to our guest, Alan Phillips, WA0YAS.
Of course, like everybody else, I joined the service. I did a 4-year tour in the Marine Corps, Marine Infantry, a grunt. but anyhow, I had this little bandana. I guess they call them skull caps now or whatever, but you know, like the old biker thing, you had a little flap on it, you tie it in the back. And we were at this one place, it was called the Riverfront Bar and Lounge in York County in Wrightsville, PA. And the building was actually built in 1854, so you could actually see, and it had still had the dirt cellar, and you could see, like, the way they would build up the wall for the cellar from that time frame, okay? So it was myself and Nancy. Now, this is 3 a.m. It's a July morning, and it's Sunday morning, actually. The bar's closed. The only cool place in the bar is at the bar itself, where they have the air conditioner running. Now, other than that, the coolest spot, again, was the basement. And that was a whopping chilly 85 degrees. The hottest spot was up on the third floor of the building, which used to be 2 apartments, which was like, at that point, was about, I think we had a reading of the hottest spot being 115 degrees. So anyhow, Nancy and I had went down there. And again, she's the other half. She's the best half, actually. But we went down there. We thought, well, we'll take the cellar first. Now, what was really strange about this, we had sat down, and the cellar was divided in 2 halves. We were in the back half, and even before we sat down, we heard a female voice as clear as day say hi to us. So we got sat down. Now, there was some cans, plastic bags, where they had the recycling and stuff. So, and, of course, there was no way anybody could come up behind us. My back was, like, catty-cornered in a chair against the wall, and hers was, like, facing straight out. Well, before I get to the good part, we heard voices in the front half of the cellar, sound like 3 or 4 people talking. But the only thing about that was it wasn't discernible, but you could hear them talking. But anyways, back to what I was saying is we sat down in this chair, and it felt like she jumped up. And for any of us to get really worked up, you know, it's got to be something that's really, I guess, amazing, is for lack of a better word, because we're not kids, you know, we don't, it takes a lot to really get us going and get us to jump. But anyways, she jumped up and she goes, quick, take a picture. I said, well, have you? Since it felt like either spider webs or somebody shot a spitball at me. I go, what? Well, sure enough, in the picture, you see what looks like a raindrop. Now, what was funny is, instead of going down vertically like rain usually does, this is flying at her horizontally. And you see the strands of hair where she shook her head. And we did it and took it and put it into a negative version. And there's that still trail from that little drop of whatever it was. I say it was a vertical raindrop or a horizontal raindrop flying as she's shaking her head. Now, it's not flying away from her hair like shaking your head, you know, to get the sweat off. This is coming at her. So that was one incident. And eventually after that, I said, okay, well, let's get down to business. So I go, the young lady that said hello to us when we first came in the cellar, if you're still here with us, can you do something to convince me? Whoever did that was great, but I want to talk to the lady that said hello to us. So convince me you're here. So I'm sitting there, and all of a sudden, now remember, you're talking 85 degrees. We're soaked with sweat and everything. Something grabs my arm just below my elbow, and there was, like, just right in that area, just, like, immense static. Like, my hairs were standing up, I thought, anymore, and somebody was going to have to pour starch on my arm to get him any straighter. But I said, okay, this is cool. You know, I understand that. I said, but you got to convince me. Do something. Well, that happened the second time. I said, this isn't good enough. If you don't want to really convince me, fine, I understand. We'll let you go, and we'll move on. And if you want us to go, just say so, and we'll do so. Well, anyhow, I would say within 5 minutes after I said that, I felt this really cold chill. And next thing you know, again, you got to keep in mind for the skeptics, there is no way that anyone could have come up behind us without us knowing it. But something gently lifted the flap of my bandana up and sent it back down. And just as quick as I felt that, and that was done, the chill left. Now, what was amazing, now this is what we call personal experience, which unless you can document it, it's really worth about as much as rubbing two wooden nickels together, okay? But what made this interesting is I had told Mike when he come down, because we switch every so often to cover more areas, okay, and we're usually in teams of two, but he come down with another one of our investigators, and I said, Mike, you're not going to believe what happened. I just had the most unusual personal experience in the world, and I told him. Now, we had this on our digital voice recorder as well as our video, and one of the things we like to do is we like to take the mini mag lights and set them to where the slightest tap will either light them up or light them off, and a lot of people, if you see it, they say, oh, well, that's rigged. Well, come with us on one of our investigations. We'll show you it's not rigged. You know, you can sit us and watch us set it up and everything and then see for yourself. But anyhow, he's sitting in there in the basement with our camcorder going and one of our investigators holding a digital voice recorder. And Mike goes, one of our friends was down here earlier, and he said you were playing with him. And he goes, as a matter of fact, Alan told me that you lifted his bandana. Was that you? Well, like a split second after he says, was that you, the flashlight lights up, and like a millisecond after you see the flashlight light up in the video, you hear a female voice, which to me sounded like she had like a sort of a cocky attitude. You hear, yeah, like, yeah, I did it, so what? And then what made that really amazing is when we played this, the digital voice recorder back that the other investigator had at the same time, you hear female voice again going, yeah. So that turned a personal experience into actual evidence. So that was good. I mean, that was a trip, you know. That was like, for us, that was like the ultimate. So that's, they have good uses, but you know, like anything else, you got to be able to sit there and know where to look and really how to use your audio equipment to where you can discern these things in the same way, like I said earlier about with Frank's box or the ghost box. So it takes time, and it takes, like anything, that little bit of time to listen. It's almost like when you're out there and you have that rare DX station and you got this massive pile up, and finally you sit there and throw your call out there. So you're listening through all this pile up for this guy to finally come back to your call. You know, you have to develop the hearing much in the same way for your EVP evidence as you do with the ham radio when you're trying to get that rare DX entity.
You know, I guess I want to say, once again, for folks that are just tuned in, they're saying, what are you guys talking about? What we are talking about, and who I have with me here, is Alan. His call sign is WA0YAS. He's from Pennsylvania. And they have a group called, what is it, Ghost Hunters, Inc.?
Yeah, Ghost Hunters, Inc., yeah.
Okay, and there's a website, incidentally, too, you can go to. And that is Ghost Hunters, Inc., I think. Is that not the URL for that? Or is it?
Yep, ghosthuntersinc.net.
Okay. Now, you have, and all this ghost hunting stuff, for the most part, is electronic devices. And we talked a little earlier about this thing called an ovulus. It has a vocabulary in it of about 5, maybe 10,000 words. I don't know. And it, when you go into a place that supposedly has paranormal activity, it'll trigger it. And certain words will come out. And it's really uncanny that the words that do come out will generally directly relate to whatever it is that's in the area going on. We talked about the Frank's box, and we talked about the K2 meters, which are measuring actually EMF, I guess, is what they're measuring. They will either measure electronic potential, like electrostatic energy or electromagnetic energy or a combination of the two. Am I correct in this?
Yeah, Ted, yeah, that's exactly right. And you can even by now, like, of course, as far as from the amateur radio operator's point of view, you know how you have these little devices where you can go and detect RF interference, like maybe from a telephone pole where it's bleeding out of the phone line, or maybe from electric bleeding through from a phone line where there might be some kind of gap, you know, for that maybe interfering with your radio or something. Well, basically, we have also it has the same type of devices like that to where we can also detect RF. So it all boils down to, like you said, your EMF, which is your electromagnetic fields or forces, some people say, electrostatic, and of course, in some cases, your ELF or your extra low frequency, as well as your RF frequency. So there's many different devices that you can use to measure different stuff like that to be sure. Just like, you know, with your ham radio, you want to make sure your audio is not too hot. And you want to make sure if you're running, say, like on 60 meters where you have a restricted power output, which in that case would be nowadays 100 watts ERP, you want to make sure you stay within that so, you know, your dBs don't increase to where you go over that and kind of create a little RFI from, say, I guess it's government places on the 60-meter band since we're only secondary users. So there's so many ways that somebody listening could wonder, well, how does ham radio principles apply with ghost hunting? So that's just one of the many ways that you can think of, and I'm sure as we go on, there's probably thousands of more.
Well, I was going to say, I had participated in several, I guess I want to say, investigations where I had gone out, and we'd carried electronic equipment with us. And one of the things that was really strange is when those K2 meters were going off, a great device to have with you is Martin Jew's frequency counters. They're real sensitive, and they've got an LED display that goes across the front that shows frequency, field strength. And if you pull the whip antenna all the way out, they are really sensitive, you know. So anything going on in the area in the way of RF now is going to cause a deflection on that meter. And it was really strange because we found that when we saw the K2 meters going off, the MFJ frequency counters would wind up somewhere around 500 megahertz. Now, they didn't land on a specific frequency. It was like you would see the frequency counter in its idle state, clocking whatever it does. But then when the EVP, or I'm sorry, the K2 meters would go off, the frequency counter would shift up into around 500, 600 megahertz. Of course, it was skipping all over the place. But you could definitely see a shift there. And I thought, well, see, this energy evidently is centered somewhere around 500 megahertz, whatever it is. So I that's why I think it'd be really cool to see a bunch of hams get involved in this, because some of these fellows technically are way over my head, and the things they could come up with would be absolutely, I think, amazing. You know, so anyhow. You play back the EVPs, and you've had some actual physical reaction. Well, on that one investigation that we were on, we were up in a bedroom, the lights were totally out, and my son Matt had an infrared camera. He was the only one in the room that could see anything. And someone was talking and saying, you know, are you here? If you're here, do something, let us know. And all of a sudden, I felt something tugging on the back of my shirt. And Matt right away spoke up. He said, Dad? I said, what? He says, something's pulling on your shirt. He can see it in the camera. Of course, we caught it on video, you know. But, I mean, it was really weird. I mean, I'd never had anything like that before. And it was, I mean, this was real. I mean, this thing was pulling on the back of my shirt. And there was no hands, nobody around. The whole room was full of people surrounding this bed. And, of course, no one could see anything. The only person that could see anything was him with a camera. And I'll tell you, you have a couple of those kind of things go on, and it'll really make you scratch your head, you know, because, what is it that you're dealing with? All right, now, with all that said, you've got the EVPs. Now, what's handy about this is if you do it on a pocket recorder and it's got a USB connection on it, you can shove it right into a notebook and open it up in an audio editor like Adobe Audition or Sony, SoundForge.
Or Audacity, Yeah, now, they have Audacity, too.
Audacity is a free program, public domain, and you can open up in one of those. And you can see the waveform going all the way across, so it's a little easier to pick out an anomaly. However, I have heard stuff on those things that you didn't necessarily see in the waveform. So sometimes it's a helpful shortcut to be able to go through the waveform and find little spots that look irregular. But sometimes there's a voice there, and there's no deflection in the waveform whatsoever. Have you ever seen that?
Yeah, that's mostly the way that we come across it. And it's amazing because, you know, like you said, you don't see no deflection in the waveform, but then it's like, you know, it's just straight across top and bottom. It's like, whoa, where'd that come from? So you go back, and like you said, you highlight it. And, of course, sometimes after we highlight it, we'll make it a little bit bigger to where we just see that area. It's like, oh, my goodness, where did that come from? Here, we're looking right over this stuff, and it's right under our nose. It sort of like slaps us in the face and say, wake up, you know, get more caffeine, get more coffee. Just wake up and start looking. You guys are falling asleep. So, yeah, it's happened to us quite a few times. I mean, there's been stuff that we've never even thought would exist. I mean, we've had sometimes it'd be just, like I said, like you and I are talking. Other times you would have to listen, and it would be more like in a melodic type thing, you know. So it's kind of strange. As a matter of fact, funny you mentioned about barn, because we did this bed and breakfast, as a matter of fact. It's called Battlefield Bed and Breakfast. It's right out there, dead smack dead center of the Gettysburg Battlefield. And the farmhouse was built in 1809. The owner and builder was Cornelius Houghton, and his wife and his family lived there. But we had one of our infrared cameras set up in the barn. And what was so funny is if you look in the video, you see some kind of chain. I don't remember what it was, but it's hanging up there. You see this chain start moving. Now, nobody was out there, and we had our one infrared wireless set up. And you see this chain start swinging. Then you see a ribbon of light just appear out of nowhere, turn around like, you know, if you'd wrap a ribbon around a Christmas tree, disappear to where if you go in the barn, would have been the left side of the barn. And as it goes behind it, it turns into what some people call, what we call orbs. Now, some people don't take a lot of, they'll say orbs are really not spirit related or whatever, it's dust or whatever. But what I found out about this that was so amazing, it's this ribbon light. After I see this chain in our evidence shaking in a video, then all of a sudden there's this ribbon light that like swirls around the pole, goes to the back behind there, and then all of a sudden you see this so-called orb go and just shoot towards the front of the barn. It's like, whoa, wait a minute, this is strange. And another incident, again, same place, Battlefield Bed and Breakfast in Gettysburg. We had one of our investigators in the barn, and he's doing an EVP session. He said, was there any wounded brought here from the battlefield today? And shortly after that, you hear a male voice go, no battle. Like, at that point, apparently, there was nothing going on. It's like laid back. But we've had, and in the same house, we've had stories, some of the claims that they had was an icy hug from what appeared to be a child, which that was verified by Nancy, and she at this time wasn't able to go on that investigation because she wasn't feeling well, but she went on the reveal why she had to have it to her. They supposedly seen a Civil War Union soldier, probably like an officer or something, roam around. And things would happen in some of the guest room. And one of the main things that really amazed us was supposedly guests would be out looking out their windows like 3 a.m. in the morning, and they would see what they described as lanterns. Now, this was really neat because we're sitting there, and what was the dining area, the kitchen of this farmhouse, was now what they called the parlor. So they had a TV in the one window. Now, we had our cameras. We had set up, actually, it was a camcorder, infrared camcorder, little Sony, had it set up on a tripod pointing to this TV to where you could see off to the right. And what was amazing is about 3 o'clock in the morning, like the guest had told the owner, which Florence, by the way, was a heck of a host, but we see, when we review this, we see this light coming, like if you would look at a light, like a lantern off in the distance coming towards you, getting brighter, it stopped. And I'd say for about 10 seconds, then it's like got a little bit dim, and then you see it move off to the left. Now, what was amazing about this is considering where the cars are parked and compared in reference to this window, there would be no way that it would shine across into the window like that to create that effect. I mean, we tried all kinds of ways to recreate it. No luck. I mean, we even did the flash, took a flashlight out, tried a flashlight, come towards it with a flashlight. Nothing. So after all, so it's like, okay. So we showed that to Florence on the reveal, and she was like, her chin just chopped. I mean, it was like, wow. And then we heard, and again, back to the EVPs, we sit there and we did an EVP session. Again, one of them was with the ghost box, and I go, can you say my name? Now, my Indian name, which I use sometimes, is Wolf Shadow. So I use Alan Wolf Shadow. So I said, can you say my name? And you hear Alan Wolf Shadow. It's like, whoa. Now, the other investigator with us that was there, he goes, well, can you say my name? And you hear again, Scott Wise. Now, the main thing was really interesting. I said, can you tell me your name? And you hear Ted. And then you said, well, Ted, what are you doing here? And with that southern accent, you hear like soldier. So we say, are you a soldier? Say, yeah, soldier. So that was kind of interesting. And I could go on, but there was, I mean, there's been like anything else. We've been lucky, and there's other times we'll spend a whole 8 hours and it's nothing. It's like a dry spell. But, you know, I could go on. I mean, I could probably sit there and go on forever. And I'm the type of person, sometimes if I get a little going, you know, you might have to tell me, hey, back off a little bit and give us a chance. Because, you know, I love the ghost investigations as much as ham radio. And I can get into some other stuff, which I can tell you about if we have the time, that I got from some other people in the area. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you ever heard of the MUFON, which is the Mutual UFO Network.
Oh, yeah.
I had the Pennsylvania State Director contact us about some stuff, which, like I said, at another point in time, if you want, we can get into that.
We have a local, we have a Tennessee MUFON organization, and they have their conventions every year. And generally speaking, we've had Stanton Friedman on as a guest. I don't know if you know who Stanton is, but Stanton's been around for years doing. He's a physicist and does the UFO investigations. He's an expert on Roswell, total complete expert on it. The fellow that did the movie Fire in the Sky, I'm trying to think what his name is right off the top of my head. I can't think, but it was a pretty, I guess I want to say, prominent abduction story. We did an interview with him. It was quite, the film is out, been out for a long time, called Fire in the Sky, and I can't think, it was, for some reason, his name just escapes me. The thing is that I think it would be interesting for folks that are skeptical about this. You know, I would say grab a little pocket recorder and go off someplace and turn that thing on and let it run. And then come back and listen to what you have on there. You may be totally amazed. I know I was. I mean, I didn't think that any of that stuff was legitimate, or even it was just all, you know, people's imagination and that sort of thing. But it's not at all. There's some pretty real stuff. I was going to say, the places that you investigate, though, now are most of these places reported to have a haunting or have some sort of spirit activity, or do you do random sort of investigations? And I guess my question is how many times do you come up empty-handed? How many times do you go in with all the equipment, you sit there, and nothing happens?
Well, first of all, most of them are anywhere from churches to businesses to private residences. And as far as coming up empty-handed, I'd say maybe 4 out of 5 or 1 out of 5 will come up empty-handed. And for a while, it was getting to the point to where we were doing, I guess, and of course, to a lot of people, may not sound like a lot, but we were doing 2 investigations a month. But then when you sit down and think of it, the work involved, you know, going back to the client, going through your evidence and getting to the client to give them what you've collected and stuff, 2 cases a month, you know, that's a heck of a lot. Plus, we've done lectures at local libraries now coming up, and we've got 2 libraries in our area, the Boone Area Library in Birdsboro, which is maybe about 15 minutes away from us, and the local library, which is just right down the road from us, which is the West Lawn Library. They have programs for their teens in the summer, and the one for West Lawn we had set up for last year. They wanted us to come and do a program for the teens, and then, of course, it seemed to be spreading like wildfire, but then the Boone Area Library contacted us, and again today, I just got another library contact us, which was the Brandywine Community Library, which is in Taunton, PA. Now, for those of you who have seen a lot of these shows, the one on the Sci-Fi Channel, Ghost Hunters, that TAPS crew was at Taunton, PA. And some of you who watched the episode might remember the building as the Taunton House / Hotel. Well, we investigated that, and it was under new management. It was called White Palm Tavern. Now, if you remember the episode, TAPS didn't find a doggone thing. Well, on the other hand, we went out there, and in one of our videos, again, we were doing the flashlight thing, and we have it up on YouTube. We also have a YouTube channel as well, but if you look in the video, you see like a white come up out of nowhere, and you see like a head and shoulders, and then you see it slowly fade out again. Now, we slowed that down to three times, and you can actually watch it better. Now, you don't hear the audio like you do when you see it normal speed, but you can see it just like almost like come up out of nowhere, see what looks like the head and shoulders, and then just tapers down to like a body, and then just as quick as it came, you see it fade out into nothingness. So that was kind of weird. And I even told Mike when I seen this, I said, Mike, you got to check this video out. You got to slow it down. Tell me if you see what I saw. And again, he was going, wow, you know, that's interesting. And when we showed this stuff to the owner of the White Palm Tavern, a.k.a. Taunton House, he just, like, looked at us and he goes, wow. I mean, he was like, he's about as skeptical as skeptic can be. He told us, I'm a skeptic. I'll admit it. You know, you got to give me concrete evidence. He said, my wife's into it, but I got, you know, if you can give me concrete evidence, if you can tell me something that will convince me. And he said one of them his wife caught on a voice recorder was initials. He said, you can come tell me them initials or whatever, then I'll believe. Well, we sit there, we told him what we thought the initials were. He goes, you know what, that's close enough. And he just told us what the initials were. So he just, like, was totally flabbergasted at what we had come back with. But so it's interesting. I mean, you know, it's just one of them times, like I said, one out of five. There's times we can sit there and go into something and walk out. But so far, we've been lucky.
I was going to say the one item that we never talked about, and that was the digital thermometers and the infrared thermometers, which are, you have digital readout on them. And one thing that'll happen if you have paranormal activity, as a rule, one thing that can happen is you get these cold spots. You can see them. In other words, you can actually watch the temperature drop in the room from, say, like you said, if it's 85 degrees, you can see it drop all the way down to 60 degrees. And, you know, I mean, maybe some more than that, I don't know, but I know that it's been, I've heard people talk about the fact that they've been in places where it's been like 80 degrees and all of a sudden it would drop so cold you could see your breath. And
Yeah, absolutely.
And they could see this on these thermometers, and then, of course, they would have video running. So you would see the display, you know, actually drop. So, you know, and all these little tools are well within the grasp and the reach of the common person. And, of course, what I'm saying is what could ham operators come up with? What kind of things could be built to carry this even further? You know, I mean, it's kind of scary to think when you turn a bunch of MacGyvers loose.
yeah.
You know, creating equipment, you know, to do things like paranormal investigations. In your amateur radio career, I guess I want to call it that. That's probably a good term. What have you found, or what have you found that's aided you in doing paranormal investigations? In other words, what is it about being a radio amateur that's enhanced your ability in that area?
Well, I guess, like I said earlier, when, you know, everybody's got that big DX station, that rarity that they want to go for. So I would say being able to have to sit there and listen and put your ear right up to the speaker, per se, and listen to be able to pull that weak station out, whether it's, you know, a stateside or whether it's around the block or even if it's somewhere overseas, being able to pull that weak station out and listen and really, I guess, be able by that, you learn to, I guess, enhance your hearing to the point where sooner or later you pick out these things, like from your EVPs or just like if you're somewhere sitting in a room listening, you learn from this to where you can hear a footstep of somebody walking across a floor that you know is actual somebody walking, or whether it's something that's in the ether world, the other realm, or whatever you choose to do it, or anything of that nature. Your hearing is enhanced because you're listening and you're wanting to hear that weak station. But, you know, you like, for example, you're sitting there, you have a station that's coming in at S5, but at the same time, you got QSB that's right around, say, at S4.5 or maybe somewhere. So you're able to pull that weak station, who is just above that noise level, out and be able to have, you know, maybe not Q5 QSO, but you're able to at least get maybe a 5.5 or 4.5 or something to where you have a QSO and understand what's said, even though you may not be able to do a rag-chewing type thing, but at least exchange information and get a report. Or like in some cases with CW, you get your RST and you change a little bit about your equipment and stuff like that. So that's being able to do that with amateur radio has enhanced to where I can be able to sit there and pick this stuff up, whether it's going through our evidence, like on our audio and stuff, or whether it's just sitting in the same room with our cameras and our and all that stuff. So it's, to me, it's like, wow, did I hear that? And it's like I said again, it's that rear DX. You say, okay, this guy is in 10x2, but he's really weak. And, you know, again, it goes back to it's enhanced my hearing ability to the point to where, yes, I know what I heard, and I know it's real, and there's no doubt in my mind. And, you know, and it has so many other things because also you learn to, like, I used to have the tendency of, especially when I'd be on FM, I would get a little too close to the mic, and my audio would get hot. So I learned how to talk a little bit slower, a little bit less boisterous, I guess is probably a better term. And so, and all this, it's like,
well, you've learned
how you should do.
Yeah, I was going to say, you've learned the mechanics of how a microphone works, and you've learned what's inside a microphone. And you know, when these when you're doing the EVP recordings, you have a little bit different concept of it than, say, the person that's not in amateur radio. I mean, you understand what an LED is and what makes it light up. So, I mean, I think that maybe radio amateurs doing ghost investigations are going to have a completely different perspective than the average layperson walking in that has absolutely no electronics background at all, because you know what it's going to take, or you know what it takes to make that equipment work or to make it register. And I think that would make a huge difference, especially dealing with these little boxes like the Ovula and the Frank's box and things like that. I mean, you've got a little bit better grasp of what electronics is inside that thing and how it works. So, you know, you don't, I guess you could avoid putting it in compromised areas. Like, for example, you aren't going to want to do this where there's a lot of RF, you know, a big RF field of some sort.
Or, right, right.
You know, and you're going to understand that, where I think the average layperson just wouldn't, you know, they haven't ever had that in their life. They've never had to study it, or, you know, there's never been a part of anything that they do. They're just interested in the ghost hunting part. So, you know, having a ham around, having one of these MacGyvers around, I can see could really, really be an asset. Well, let me kind of go backwards here a little bit, because we're just about out of time. I wanted to cover this area, and that is, and I don't know, I may have asked you this question before, but do you feel like, all right, your interest in the paranormal and getting involved in that and using all the various electronics to do monitoring and that sort of thing, how does that relate to your Cherokee Indian background? I mean, I know that's something that kind of fascinates me, because you said something happened and that kind of got your attention, and that was the thing that really kind of spurred your interest in paranormal things. But I'm curious as to how the Cherokee background fits into, say, for example, what you find, the results that you get, how you relate that to other people. That would be fascinating to hear. So that's why I'm asking the question.
Okay, well, I would say probably in effect, again, like I said earlier, we were taught that all things on Earth, or as we would say, Mother Earth, is living. Everything has a spirit, whether it's a rock, a tree, or whatever. So with that note, I would sit there, and we were taught with this stuff that there really is nothing to be afraid of. Yes, there are some things you want to be aware of that could be malicious and play jokes, which is what is known. Some people might have other different terms, but in the Native American world, they're known as a trickster, the Lakota, and the Sioux, which are different variations. They're the same nation, but different tribes, different nations within the
Or in the, in the religious realm, just the old-fashioned word demons or devil, you know, would be a good example.
Yeah, that'd be a good term. And then, like I said, in the native world, it's either Tomi the spider, or it's the fox, or the tricksters, that sort of thing. But, you know, we've learned that, yes, this does exist. So, basically, you keep yourself in a state.
You're listening to the QSL Radio Show. And we'll be right back with our guest, Alan Phillips, WA0YAS, right after this. If you already own a TW2010 Adventurer or Backpacker antenna, and you want to use the antenna on 40 meters, you can get the Trans World Adventurer 4040 Array Box in center section only, right now only $139.95. That puts you on 40 meters, and you're dealing with the exact same antenna structure that has made the TW2010 Trans World Adventurer so famous. The black powder coating, the stealth, the way the antenna is able to hide. And in addition to that, it's portable if you want to take it with you. Of course, you can get it with a deluxe travel bag. It's just fantastic. Go to the website and check it out, transworldantennas.com. That's transworldantennas.com. If you can't remember Trans World Antennas, just remember to go to our website at QSO, tedrandall.com, TEDRANDALL.com, and click on the link for Trans World Antennas. Take a look at this brand new Adventurer 4040. That's all the time we have for QSO this week. We'd like to invite you back next week, same time, same station. And a special thanks going out to our guest today, Alan Phillips, WA0YAS 73.